You're with Hindsight, and we're in Japan exploring tensions and debates over history. In trying to understand contemporary Japan's complex and ambivalent relationship with its 20th century history, a visit to the city of Hiroshima is instructive. Today, walking through the city's glossy shopping arcades, and from the windows of the trams which trundle along tree-lined boulevards that are so clean and painfully neat, it's difficult to imagine that this place was also that other Hiroshima, the site for the dropping of the atomic bomb, loaded with all that weight of history. After the events of 1945, it's not surprising that Hiroshima was the site for Japan's emerging peace movement. And if Japan hosts other museums like the Yasukuni in Tokyo, which appear to glorify its military past, then Hiroshima, with its well-known peace memorials and its World Heritage-listed A-bomb dome, offers a fairly powerful counter-story of the nation. It's impossible to visit the Hiroshima Memorial Peace Museum and not be moved. The full horror of what happened to the city's civilian population is laid out in graphic imagery and in testimonial. Whatever the wartime justification for the dropping of the A-bomb, a visit to this museum leaves one unequivocal about the cost it exacted on the people of Hiroshima. And like other war memorials around the world, the Hiroshima Peace Museum is a mandatory school excursion for children in Japan. But the Peace Museum does have its critics. Yuki Tanaka from the Hiroshima Peace Institute is one of them.
The museum is pathetic in a way because you see that they don't have even a single photo of Nagasaki. It's only Hiroshima. And when I came here 6 years ago, I was, invited to give a public lecture. And the first thing I said, museum have to be changed, you know. And that was a shock to the people in Hiroshima. I mean, for example, then we talk about the victims of radiation, and there's hardly talk about the victims of the nuclear test. No single photos of, say, Aborigines who were exposed to radiation.
Marilyn.
Or, you know, Southwest Pacific Islanders were exposed to radiation. Or the agents, exposed to Russian and Chinese nuclear tests. Mm-hmm. There's none. So they pretend that, you know, we are the only victims of the nuclear war, radiation. That's not good. It's not surprising that the people forgetting this Hiroshima issue. You know, I'm not denying the huge impact on the people who visit the museum. Nonetheless, I think it's a very narrowly focused. Somehow, if we really want to maintain the Hiroshima issue and the spirit of Hiroshima, we have to somehow introduce the major change to the exhibition of the museum.
While Yuki Tanaka believes that the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima was an inhumane and unnecessary act, he's also critical of the way in which the event has been absorbed into a strange kind of post-war consciousness in Japan. He argues that the historical experience of the A-bomb has given license to a sensibility that only ever sees one great victim of the Second World War, the Japanese, and that this sense of victimhood obviates any ability to recognise the country's role as a perpetrator of violence during the war.
The anti-nuclear movement and peace movement here in Hiroshima is very narrowly focused on their own experience. Mm. So they highlight the victimisation of the citizens of Hiroshima, especially Hibakusha. I don't blame them. And of course, there's the symbolically important to have, you know, the voices of the Hibakusha, and they, I think, contributed enormously to anti-nuclear movement. Nonetheless, because of the narrowly focused on their own experience, they tend to see their own experience is a very unique, and there's no common element to share with other victims of war. the Hiroshima bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is a typical example of the indiscriminate bombing of civilians. Although it was the bomb used for it's very unique atomic bombs, but Tokyo people in Tokyo, Dresden, London, you name it, you know, large number of other civilians also became the victims of the indiscriminate bombings. If we don't try to extend our view and try to establish the solidarity between Hiroshima people and the victims of other war, our movement becomes very weak. Especially when the Hibakusha passed away, then we have no one to tell the story.
In 2006, a group of Japanese peace scholars, including Yuki Tanaka, organized an event called the International People's Tribunal on the dropping of the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Over 2 days in the July of that year, defendants of the dropping of the bomb, including Presidents Roosevelt and Truman, US military chiefs and nuclear scientists such as Robert Oppenheimer, argued their case to a panel of 3 real-life judges. The judges included American professor of international and criminal law, Lennox Hind from Rutgers University, as well as Carlos Varga, who teaches international law at Costa Rica University. The plaintiffs in the tribunal were made up by the Hibakusha, the living A-bomb survivors, as well as citizens of both Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The event was open to the public, who could witness the enactment of a trial which might have, under different historical circumstances, taken place 60 years previously. And while the People's Tribunal had no real legal power, it did have great symbolic clout and a clear purpose: to promote the idea of peace and also to demonstrate that it's possible to redress historic wrongdoings.
I thought, okay, we have to emphasize the criminality of the bombing of civilians. No nation has done it. So I thought we'll bring this People's Tribunal in Hiroshima. But at the same time, we are focusing on or emphasizing the fact that the bombing of civilians is a crime against humanity, no matter where it was conducted.
I urge Japanese civilians to leave industrial cities immediately and save themselves from destruction.
Looking west from Zero Point, the same complete leveling is evident, the same inability of structures to withstand atomic power.
I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb.
Outlined in the surface of the bridge is the shadow of a pedestrian which tells its own meaningful story.
My parents died because the oldest son of the family went to Manchuria and came back with tuberculosis toward the end of the war. Our parents contracted the tuberculosis. In those days, there was no medicine, and they died one after another. The brother died, and the mother died, and the father died. So when I was 15 years old, I had no parents. But when I came to Hiroshima and realized the much worse situation Hiroshima citizens had to go through because of the atomic bombing, I realized that the suffering I had to go through was nothing.
Like many Japanese of his generation, the life of Dr. Mitsuo Okamoto has been directly shaped by the Second World War. An emeritus professor at Hiroshima Shudo University, he pioneered the development of peace studies in Japan and has taught in universities around the world. In the last few years, Dr. Okamoto's interest has been keenly trained on the public campaign in Japan to stop the government from changing the Article 9 clause in the country's constitution. This clause effectively limits Japan from entering combat troops in international conflicts. Article 9 has been a legal thorn in the side of various Japanese governments, from the first Gulf War to the current conflict in Iraq. For peace activists such as Dr. Okamoto, the Constitution itself holds great symbolic weight, Created in 1946 during the Allied post-war occupation, the constitution signified the end of the old imperial Japan and laid the foundation for the modern democracy in place today.
I'm a child of Article 9 when I became junior high school student immediately after war. We were introduced this new constitution, and we were excited because it was an atmosphere where we hated war, partly because we lost the war. I don't know how we would have felt if we had won a war, but the reality was the defeat, and democracy was introduced, and we had more freedom. We had joy to study, and I think those years were truly years of the burgeoning democracy in this country after a long time of the militarism and authoritarian system. Yeah, that's why I said I'm a child of the Article 9.
Can you remember as a young man when you were studying Japanese history at high school, whether the more sensitive aspects of Japan's modern history, perhaps Korea, China, or even the Second World War, can you remember the way it was taught?
You see, it's already 24 years since I became a teacher. When I was a student, I was in the middle of the post-war so-called democratic education. And I was born in Hiroshima Prefecture and brought up here. Hiroshima used to be, well, still, I hope, is a center of peace education in Japan. So in addition to the A-bomb experiences, we were taught about Japanese aggression into Asian countries. Affected their lives, and also we were taught about the post-war or compensation issues, war victims, and all the rest of it. But ever since the 1990s, the history revisionists found the post-war democratic education, including peace education, a great obstacle for what they want to achieve. So they started to attack the education, democratic education and peace education.
Seishi Hinata teaches at a local state high school in Hiroshima, and he's also involved in peace and pro-democracy groups, including his local chapter of the Article 9 Association. He's experienced firsthand the impact of a group of conservative neo-nationalists who've targeted education as the source of a perceived decline in national standards. The group has made it their mission to revise the content and tone of Japanese history textbooks. Like Australia, Japan has seen its own history war around teaching, and the rhetoric coming from the conservative history warriors in Japan is also strangely familiar. They claim that the accepted post-war interpretation of Japanese history is far too apologetic, too masochistic, gloomy, and full of self-loathing. And it seems that this group of conservative neo-nationalists, founded by education academic Nobukatsu Fujioka, has garnered support in some powerful quarters in Japan.
You see, the group like Professor Fujioka insists that the post-war Japanese democratic education or peace movement sees Japanese history in a so-called self-flagellatory or self-flagellant way.
Masochistic.
Punishing ourselves for the sin we have, depriving younger population of their pride, national pride. But it sounds really weird to our generation. You see, we have to face the history. But for younger generation, there is a room that those ideology goes straight into their mind because they were not taught enough about the history of anything. So I think it is really dangerous to dismiss their influence, because they have a very strong social and political network among the Japanese business world, Japanese political world, and even the mass media. What happens in, for example, here in Japan, when they attack peace education in Hiroshima, well, I find a very strong tripartite alliance among those group and local conservative politicians, and also the local conservative media. And they have a very strong impact upon the public population.
Professor Fujioka's group went ahead and wrote their own history textbook. Their book skews the motives which led to Japan's entry in the Second World War. For example, there's no specific reference to Japan having invaded other countries. Rather, these acts are described as advancement.
Their basic thinking is to depict Japanese past history as beautiful as possible, so that the young people can have a positive view of Japanese past history, so that they can have confidence in the integrity of Japanese people in the past. You know, this is ridiculous. This is a ridiculous view of education. We have to teach the objective past, both dark side and sunny side, so that the young people will not have doubts. If they are taught only the sunny side, positive side, one day they will have doubt. We learned so much about the dark side of American history, dark side of British. Don't we have dark side of history in Japan?
If you have a look at the Japanese textbook, it covers from ancient Japan to the modern time, including a wartime period. But because they start, you know, from ancient time, so by the time that the third year of the high school, they are not covering the whole textbook. So towards the end of the textbook, that's its contemporary history, including war issues, are totally ignorant. They are concentrating on, say, culture in Edo period, this marvelous, you know, theater, you know, no kabuki, yes, flower arrangement, that's important too. But, you know, by the time that they come to the contemporary issues, the schooling is finished. At the, for example, the exams, entrance exams at the universities, the questions on the contemporary history, a hard read comes up. So this is the problem. And I'm sure that the Japanese government is very happy with this arrangement. So they don't try to change this.
The first study group aimed for to pointing out issues and problems in Japanese history textbooks. However, the second study group tried to make textbook which could be used in both countries.
That's Professor Kimijima Kazuhiko. He's on the front line of an important counter-offensive to the conservative historical revisionists like Nobukatsu Fujioka. Professor Kimijima has been part of a joint Japanese-South Korean study group who came together to try and write a history textbook which could accommodate both a Korean and a Japanese interpretation of their shared history. It was no simple undertaking, as this is a history which involves the invasion, colonization, and sometimes brutal repression of the Koreans by the Japanese during the first 30 years of the 20th century. And it would take more than 10 years and two separate joint study projects before the two countries could even begin to think about the idea of a shared history textbook.
The
issue we had in the study group was different from our generally considered issue or conflict. For example, when we Japanese side write about colonial rule of Korea, if we write how cruel it was, Korean side was not always happy about it, because that could make less description about how the Korean people had independence or they had dignity. Maybe some of them reacted with arms. As a result, I would say this textbook has a lot of areas covering the Korean people's movement for they seek for independence. So this book writes this rule, very cruel rule by Japanese side, and at the same time, the Korean people had dignity and tried very hard to keep their independence in mind. So that Korean and Japanese people have more interest gradually in both in history as they have more communication and understanding culturally. However, Japanese government and Japanese politicians still goes to Yasukuni Shrine, and they make very discriminatory comments. So they still have this old concept. And Korean side, I think, they think to develop the communication in more real meaning between two countries, these issues, political issues, to be solved.
A life of bare essentials is the lot of the little men who dreamed of world rule and ended up as hosts to Uncle Sam's occupation army.
Mr. Abe himself was born into a proud political dynasty, and his grandfather, Nobusuke Kishi, a post-war prime minister, dream of revising Japan's pacifist constitution, the one imposed by the occupying Americans.
Like other governments around the world, the Japanese government has also been invoking history in order to serve present-day policies and interests. For the past decade or so, various Japanese governments have expressed their interest in abolishing the pacifist Clause 9 of the Japanese Constitution, and they've looked to history for justification. Former Prime Ministers Junichiro Koizumi and Shinzo Abe have both argued that the Constitution, which came into being in 1946 during the Allied occupation of Japan, was the work of the Americans alone, and that from the outset it was therefore not created with the interests of future Japanese in mind. The most contentious clause, Article 9, renounces war and forbids the country to have a fully fledged military. And it's something of an historical irony that the US government has expressed support for the Japanese government's desire to rewrite the Constitution. Those in Japan who want to hold on to Article 9 in the Constitution are also invoking history in their defence. Self-described child of Article 9, Dr. Mitsuo Okamoto.
The Constitution, we think, is not just American gift, but it was a collaboration of the occupation forces and the progressive Japanese constitution scholars who had been imprisoned during the war because they did not consider the imperial rule was just, but the more democratic or republican system of government was the modern. So these progressive constitutional scholars conceived, were actually written down the draft of the new constitution. They had original ideas which coincided with the ideas of the progressive American constitutional scholars who were in the GHQ. You see, so it was, in my view, a collaboration. You know, many conservative people or ordinary people say it was a MacArthur's invention. They drafted in just in 1 week or 2 weeks and just enforced to Japanese people. That's not true.
Article 9 was created because, not only because of the we Japanese were victimized by war, but also we perpetrated the war crimes, and we you know, committed war crimes against a large number of Chinese, Koreans, Taiwanese, Southeast Asians. So based on the victimization of other Asians committed by our own men and the political leaders, Article 9 was created and accepted by Japanese. Now, this historical meaning was somehow forgotten and only seen as the protection of our life. And now even this meaning is also fading away because of the lack of education. So Article 9 becomes irrelevant to younger generation.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will arrive at Tokyo Terminal in a few minutes.
Before leaving this journey through the minefield of the history wars in Japan, a final word from some of those on the front line. What direction now for the way in which the past constantly pushes its way into present-day issues in Japan? Well, first, some strategic manoeuvres in the campaign for recognition of the Comfort Women history. Here's Mina Watanabe, director of WAM, the Women's Active Museum for War and Peace in Tokyo.
We are going to invite all the minister members, parliamentarian, to WAM, because it's a Comfort Women A to Z. So I want them to know what was the purpose, who operated, and what kind of suffering there.
You know, the revisionist school and has gone in waves over the years, you know, depending on the sort of political context in Japan. The late 1960s and early 1970s, because of the Vietnam War and because of a general upsurge of, I guess you would call it, anti-government sentiment here, was a very important period in terms of openness about history, and there were a lot of challenges to the dominant perspective of how Japan saw the war. And I think what's, if you like, scary for people like me at CIS, who would view themselves as being on the sort of liberal end of the spectrum, is that we have moved away from that now. We are moving very fast away from that now, and we're into a sort of a period of neo-nationalist hegemony, I think, or growing neo-nationalist hegemony in Japan.
It's a dark history, because you see, we committed, my father's generation committed crimes. So we are capable of doing the same things if the situation changes. So somehow we have to think about our possibility, the danger to commit the similar crimes. Mm. But not only this is the Japanese possibility, but the Americans' possibility too. As I said, you see, we have to learn from the Japanese experience and apply to the universal. But what is lacking here is the moral imagination. Learning from the war experience, victimization, and extend their moral imagination to the people we victimize, see. This kind of lack of imagination is clear here in Japan. So somehow we need to nurture this moral imagination.
You've been listening to Program 1 in the series History Under Siege, Battles Over the Past. It was produced by me, Michelle Rayner, with technical production from Carey Dell. And if you'd like more info about today's program, including transcripts and a reference list, there's also an image gallery, just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts to the special History Under Siege website.